Like to bring to order the Committee on Early Childhood Learning Finance. We had a longer session today, which started at 4 o'clock, so that's the reason we're starting late. We have people that need to get into the room at 6:30, so we do we still plan to have an hour and a half hearing. I hope those of you that are testifying can stay. If that isn't going to work, if you can let us know that ahead of time, otherwise we very much appreciate you staying with us. First up, we have House File 2983, Representative Peterson, the Office of Early Learning established. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a delete all amendment. It's H2983DE3. Is that, do I need to have this copied? It's there. It's there.
Which one is it? Is it the DE4 amendment?
DE3.
DE3.
I think so. Maybe it's DE4 by now.
Okay. I have DE3.
Is it in the
page? Oh, you're right. Sorry, it is DE4. Okay. We added. We did add. Okay, thank you. It is DE4. And what it did was, it after our last meeting, it tightened up the language a bit, and it did add an advisory board, which is already mandated through the Head Start language that we talked about last time. And so, do you want me to move that at this time?
Yes. If you want to get it in the form that you would like it.
Yeah, I would like one verbal amendment, oral amendment. And that would be to add Department of Health and Human Services, and if it would be Health and Human Services, wherever you see Human Services. Excuse me, I forgot my water too. Okay. So it's Health and Human Services.
Representative Peterson, can I ask the staff how we would word that?
So it would be. I'm sorry. You need the line. It would be 1.9. Line 1.9, the administration departments of education and Department of Health and Human Services. And wherever you see Department of Education and Health and Human Services, you would add Health and Human Services.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Ms. Lemire, is that clear? Okay. Representative Peterson, hopefully everybody has the DE4 amendment. Representative Peterson moves the DE4 amendment. Is there any discussion? Gets her it in the shape she needs it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And the amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson, if you want to present your bill to the committee.
Thank you very much. And we will try to go through this fairly briefly, but I'm very pleased once again, that Art Rolnick, who, as we said before, is an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank, a long-time friend, and I'm an admirer of his work, particularly his work in early childhood, and we're so pleased that he's taken time out of his busy schedule to be here once again to be an advocate for early childhood and to talk just about, very briefly, about this bill, which establishes an Office of Early Learning. And I will get into more specifics about the office, but he's going to talk about it just a bit generally.
Welcome to the committee. We again have the rock star of early childhood. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that Representative Peterson didn't say she admired my work on pre-Civil War banking, and I don't think you invited me here to talk about that or the subprime market or the foreclosure issue. I am the Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. My name is Art Rolnick. I also am co-director of the Early Childhood Development Collaborative. That's a collaborative with the University of Minnesota and the Federal Reserve promoting basic research, interdisciplinary research on early childhood development. I also serve on the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation Board. I'll talk a little bit about that later. I also serve as a member of the state's Board of Economists. And finally, I'm on the National Commission on the Developing Child, which is housed at Harvard. What I'd like to do in the few minutes I have this afternoon, Madam Chair, if that's okay, is talk a little bit about some research that I think brings this issue to the fore. I want to talk about early childhood development, this economic development, and I'll explain why, and try to make the case that I think the research is pretty convincing that it's economic development with probably the best public return you're going to find. Then I'll mention a little bit about MELF itself, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, what's going on here in the state. This is a private initiative with some of the your top business leaders involved in a pilot study in particular in the St. Paul area that I'll mention. And finally, I'll talk about scaling it up and why the research is pretty clear here. We should be doing this at least for all at-risk children, to make sure they're all prepared for school, that the public return, again, is very high. And in scaling that up, I think it would be critical and a very important signal to not just to the citizens of the state of Minnesota, but to many people around the country that are looking at this issue, to create an Office of Early Childhood Education, as a number of other states have done something similar. So the research, I think about this as research as economic development. The state and cities around the country spend an awful lot of public money in the name of economic development and creating jobs, and there's virtually no jobs, new jobs created, and the public return is virtually zero. And what I'm referring to is something we call the economic bidding war among the states, where we try to lure companies from Wisconsin, and Wisconsin tries to lure companies from us, and economists call this a zero-sum game, and at the end, the public does not win. There's no new jobs created, they're just moved around. These economic development programs come in various guises. We actually have argued that they violate our Constitution, they violate the Commerce Clause, and the cities and states are interfering with interstate commerce, and there's some legislation and then some court hearings on this that agree with us. But the economics is pretty clear. The economics is that we spend nationally billions of dollars, whether it's fighting over sports teams or fighting over automobile factories or software companies. Market will do this on its own. Cities and states are not creating jobs. They're moving them around maybe, and it's billions of dollars with a zero public return. So we argue in some of the work that we've done at the Minneapolis Fed with my co-author Rob Grunewald that we have a better investment for you. Not surprising, we can beat zero rate of return. We should be able to beat zero. And generally, it's education. Minnesota knows this. It's one of the reason you're living in one of the best economies in the country, in fact, in the world, is because post-World War II, we poured money into human capital, into education. We have one of the most educated workforces in the country, and because of that, you have one of the best economies. It's the reason that we have the so many top five Fortune 500 companies located here. In fact, on a per capita basis, we're number one in the country. Our women are highly educated, I think number one with high school degrees, and our overall population, I think we rank fifth or sixth in the country. So education has clearly been the reason that we've been so successful, and we've had the foresight back in the 50s, the state had the foresight to invest in human capital. But where we're clearly falling behind, not just Minnesota, but across this country, is we've had little understanding that education begins a lot earlier than kindergarten. The neuroscience research is clear on this. Prenatal to three are critical years for brain development. If a child's in a stressful environment, the brain doesn't develop properly. The brain is actually too small, they've shown, by the age of three. And then there's been an awful lot of literature showing that if you intervene in a variety of different ways with high-quality early childhood education, you can make dramatic changes in the life of a child. And we've got longitudinal studies that show that if a child gets high-quality early education, starting as early at first, that you can reduce the need for special ed, you can reduce retention rates, your teachers are more productive, your schools are more productive, the child's more likely to graduate, get a job, pay taxes, stay off welfare. The studies that we looked at, longitudinal studies, randomized control groups, the crime rate went down 50%. These are huge public savings, and I want to stress public. Rob Grunewald and I calculated the return, the public return, and it may be as high, there's various estimates here, but it may be as high as 17-18%. Inflation adjusted is what economists call a real rate of return. So I can tell you, my venture capitalist buddies, if they saw a return like that in the private sector, it would not go unfunded. So as I said, I think we can beat a zero return. Most of your economic development dollars that are going to move businesses around from city to city or state to state is a zero public return. Early childhood education done right, focused on at-risk kids, starting as early as you can make yield a very high return to the public, not just to the child, not just to the family, but to the public. So with that in mind, the state created something called the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. It consists of some of your top CEOs and business people in the state. CEO of Cargo, CEO of Ecolab, CEO of Taylor Corporation, the CEO of United Diversified, the CEO of one of the CEOs of United Healthcare, or CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield, Charlie Weaver, the Executive Director of Business Partnership that represents most of your major companies in the state on this board. This board has gone out, and we're in the process of raising $30 million privately. We've raised over half of that now, and it's allowing us to do our flagship program, which is a pilot program that based on the research that, again, that we did at the Minneapolis Fed, what we suggested as a way to create a high-quality early education system based on the research is very simple. Empower the parent, in most cases the mom. Empower the mom with scholarships. Scholarships not for 18-year-olds to go to college, but for 3- and 4-year-old children to go to high-quality early ed programs. Providers have to compete. We will pay well. Our scholarships pay up to $13,000 a year, but the providers have to develop the child, have to get the kids ready for school. In Minnesota, the metric is they have to pass the school readiness test that you've established. If you don't know, currently 50% of our kids today do not pass that test. They're not fully prepared for kindergarten. Research by James Heckman, Nobel laureate at the University of Chicago, show on average if kids don't start ready for school, they don't complete school. That's where the problem starts. So that's our program in a nutshell. The only thing I'll add to that, because we know brain development starts so early, our program also includes mentors starting prenatal. We're going to have 1,200 at-risk families that are going to be part of this program. In the Frogtown area in North St. Paul, we're identifying those families as we speak. Within a year or two, we should have significant amount of evidence to show you that indeed a program like this will work and will get a high return. We're already getting a supply response. People worried there aren't enough providers out there, high quality. New Horizons has announced that they're building some facilities in the Frogtown area. Our scholarships go with the parents, so if the parents happen to work in Edina, they can go to a high-quality program in Edina. What we're after is school readiness. That's our bottom line. I think MELF will play an important role in showing the state that this can be done and can be done well by empowering the parents and using the market system. This program is local, obviously, but it's getting national attention. There are scholarship programs starting out around the country mimicking what we're doing here in Omaha, in Sioux Falls, in Denver, and there's a number of other states, a number of the governors that we're working with that are looking at these programs. So finally, I'll talk about scaling it up and the importance of having an office for early education. It's not good enough if we're only doing this for 20-30% of our at-risk kids. The return is just too high here. So the question is, how would you do it for all the kids? We need to scale it up. Scaling it up, we think, and we were working with a number of people on this proposal, to eventually create an endowed fund, and that endowed fund would be run by an organization like MELF, with the idea that every at-risk kid in the state of Minnesota would get this kind of an opportunity. And with an endowed fund, the funding would be permanent, and so that this would go on in perpetuity. So that's how we would like to scale it up. We realize we're a little bit ahead of the curve on that. And we think it's critical to have an Office of Early Childhood Education to start bringing these results together, to start thinking about how to bring this to scale, and to bring Minnesota back where it has been for many years, as one of the leaders in this country on education and a high-quality workforce. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Peterson, do you want to talk a little bit more about the bill, and then we'll go to questions?
I will do that very quickly, and might add that the Office of Early Learning would deal with both the private and public sector. And as you know, in the whole spectrum of early childhood, we have both private and public entities that exist and are out there. And so this office would deal with both of those. And if you look at, I'm just going to quickly scan the bill, but I'll talk about basically that what this bill would do would provide a single place to go when people in early childhood, parents, other providers have an issue and want to know more about what's out there for their children. It would enable departments and an array of early childhood programs to work together more efficiently. It would create better accountability across programs. It would be an effective clearinghouse for up-to-date, accessible information on early childhood and care for all stakeholders. It would enhance the ability of early ed programs to deliver high-quality services by streamlining administrative requirements, providing educational opportunities, and supporting efficient and effective business practices in state government. It would build on the strengths of the current system, minimize weaknesses, and maximize resources, and provide timely and comprehensive information to the governor, legislature for cohesive decision-making. And if you look at this bill as it has been revamped, it talks about the governor appointing a director and who would facilitate communication and coordinate pre-kindergarten and child care programs under the administration of the Department of Education and Health and Human Services, not unlike the position that is there for higher education currently. And they have a director now for higher education who is part of the governor's cabinet, who does report directly to the governor, who facilitates and coordinates. And that's kind of the model. And this particular director would provide oversight of federal monies received from early childhood education consistent with the federal laws and regulations, including after-school programs. Now, that's not written into the language specifically, but just know that many of the federal programs go all the way up to after-school because many of our children are in after-school programs from early childhood all the way through their school years. And then in terms of coordinating and consolidating programs, they would be from birth through age 5, and they would work with MELF and Department of Health and Human Services and create common standards for quality early childhood programming, create a seamless system, encourage family choice by providing high-quality public and private programs with well-qualified professional staff, ensure that the parents have a place in planning, operation, and evaluation of the program, and be sure that there are resources, places that people can go or parents can go to find out what is available. And if you look at number 7 and 8, again, it talks about trying to develop a seamless service delivery system for early childhood care. Number 9 talks about an effective data collection system to support the functions of this particular program. And that would include, by the way, the assessments that are done for early childhood. And there are a number of them that are given either before kindergarten or in many of the programs before they enter school. And also talks about being sensitive to family values, cultural heritage. And I would go to 2.13, where this director would report to the legislative committees by February 1st of each year on the status of the work. And then the same director would also present a detailed plan with an implementation guideline to co-locate state early childhood education and child care assistance programs and services. In other words, this person has a fair amount of work to do during this year, not only to facilitate, coordinate, collaborate, but also to come up with a plan for how you kind of begin to integrate this into a department of early learning. We know that it's not going to happen overnight. It takes steps, timely steps, and a lot of work. And we have other models. We've looked at Pennsylvania, we looked at Massachusetts, other states, and they've been able to do this. And, you know, it took a year of a lot of this kind of working together, and then the co-location, and then bringing discrete strands that are appropriate for the early child programs into one spot so that we have one location where we can really begin to look at what will work for a system of early childhood in this state. In addition, last but not least, in the second page, you can see the advisory committee. Representative Slawick had that bill last year. It's an advisory committee that would work with this particular director and the governor to give advice, to get input from the field, from Mel, from all the other organizations, to talk about what are the needs and what are the recommendations that they might have. It is an advisory board, and this is also mandated by the Head Start program from the federal government, so it seems to fit in very well with this whole program. I'm very excited about this because I think it's an opportunity that we have. The time is now. There is a bill in the Senate. Senator Clark, I know, is carrying it along with Senator Bonoff, Senator Michelle. And they're also excited about this particular program, thinking it is the time. Now, it's a short time to get it through all the committees, but we think it's worth a shot. So we're here to ask for your support.
Okay. Thank you. And we do have some questions, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I agree with the intention here. I'm just curious, this is being done without any cost, apparently, and so is the governor going to just appoint somebody within his current Department of Education to fill this role? I guess that's my first question.
Well, you know, I've been struggling with that issue because we have compiled a kind of a tentative fiscal note that we haven't put on here. We debated whether there should be a fiscal note with no appropriations, and that would indeed leave it in the hands of the governor to find it within his current budget. We've been warned that he might not look on that too favorably. So we will have to determine whether we put the fiscal note on, which would be probably about $150,000 for the staff person and an assistant and what's needed for the office. And then probably $40,000, I believe, was a fiscal note for Representative Slawick's advisory committee. So it'd be close to $200,000 if you were going to put this as a fiscal note. But we'll have to decide that. This goes through a couple more committees yet, so we'll have to make that determination. I want to get some advice from some of the other authors.
Okay.
Representative Warner?
That's a good answer, I guess. Because as I look through the bill, it also, besides setting up the 12-member advisory board, it also convenes other working groups who probably would need to be reimbursed for some of their time as well. So, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being one who's always wanted smaller government and less bureaucracy, to me, this I signed on to this bill because it seems to me this might, or hopefully, it should lend to more efficiency in government, which is awful good, and I think it's worth the debate and it's worth looking at. Could you speak to any other states and how they have, the ones who have this office, can you speak to what's happening in other states across the country?
Representative Peterson?
Madam Chair, and Representative Wardlow, yes, I have talked to several of the states, and the director of the one in Pennsylvania particularly noted the efficiencies that they have recognized, not right in the beginning, but after a year, particularly after they co-located the department, they found great efficiencies because their efficiencies in terms of duplication of professional development activities, the alignment of curriculum, many of the programs which are, there are duplications in some of the programs, etc. And that's not always bad, but can there be efficiencies? Yes. And I think once you have you've analyzed the programs, you've spent a year talking about where we can find efficiency, we probably would save that much money. That's kind of a big statement, but we would definitely, there would be some efficiencies. And they had found those efficiencies in Pennsylvania.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I want to thank you, Representative Peterson, and thank you, Dr. Rolnick. It's always good to see you down here at the legislature. I appreciate you coming. Again, Representative Peterson moves that House File 2983 be heard and be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Bill. Okay, next we are going to do the minutes. City Representative Gottwald. Do you have a chance to leave the minutes?
Madam Chair, so moved.
Okay. Representative Gottwald moves approval of the minutes for February 28th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and the minutes for February 28th are passed. Next members, the remainder of the hearing is going to be on child care. Representative Bly is going to come and chair the committee. We're glad he's in the room. We were trying to decide who was going to be next. If he wasn't in the room, certainly who would chair. And I want to say thanks to all the people that are here. I know this is a bigger audience than we're used to having, so we appreciate those who are here to support child care and support early childhood issues. So thank you.
I apologize for making you anxious with this flower. As you all know, we have many things that we're working on and trying to get in line, so I apologize for being late.
We probably would have gone to Representative Eastland, but he was out of the room. And we might have gone to Peterson, well, so people know what happens if that happens again. So thank you.
Chair. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes. What we're going to do, Mr. Chair and members, is instead of having, we have three bills that are on overall child care issues. Okay. So instead of having testifiers come up for each one, separately, we're going to move the bills and move the author amendment and to lay the bill over, and then we'll hear the testimony on all three bills at once.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, there's going to be some procedural motions.
Okay.
So we can kind of get through the paperwork and get things on the table before we hear testimony about them. First of all, what I will do is make some general comments about child care and why it's important.
Okay.
And then if we can get the bills on the table, that would
okay.
be great.
Proceed.
Again, thanks to those that are here. We all know that care of our young children is one of the most important things in our society. And here at the legislature, how we affect that is through access to affordable, quality child care that supports healthy children. I think it's one of the most important things that we can do. The way we do that, of course, members, as you know, is through the Child Care Assistance Program, which helps families pay for the cost of quality child care. And the need in Minnesota is real. We know that we have more working moms in our state than most other states, and that three-fourths of families with children under the age of 13 regularly rely on some type of child care. The average cost of 4 years of child care, now members, when you think about 4 years of if you have children or neighbors or grandchildren that are going to college, what the cost of that is, the average for 4 years of child care is $30,000. So you think of our families wanting to put their kids through college, but get them off the ground at first and get them off to a good start. It's really expensive, and that's generally $30,000 would be more than 4 years of tuition at the U of M. Until 2003, our CCAP program here was a national model, but now you probably know what happened with those cuts. Thousands of working families can't use CCAP because of the below market reimbursement rates, low eligibility levels, long waiting lists, and unaffordable co-payments. Access is a real issue for our Minnesota families. Prior to 2003, Minnesota was fifth in the nation on child care eligibility. We're now 42nd. And members, I worry that now that we're going into another year, like 2003, we're going to really have to keep an eye on child care that this doesn't get cut further. As of December 2007, there were 4,035 families on the waiting list for child care assistance. Due to a freeze on the reimbursement rates to child care providers in 2003, despite small increases in subsequent sessions, we are not close to covering the actual market rate, and many providers are hurting. There has been a net loss, and I think this is really interesting, is 1,500 child care providers in the state since 2003. So if you think of 1,500 small business providers, 1,500 people that were caring for kids that are no longer doing that, one question is, what are those people doing? Are they back in the workforce, or are they stay at home, or what happened to them, but what happened to those kids, and what kind of quality care are they in? And while we've made some investments in child care assistance program in recent sessions, we have a long way to go to restoring the CCAP and ensuring all hardworking families in Minnesota have access to affordable, quality child care, both as a workforce issue and as an issue to do the right things for our kids. So, Mr. Chair, with that, if we can get the bills in shape, and then we'll have testimony from our three testifiers here today.
Okay, so Representative Slawick moves that House File 2637 be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Bill. And I understand that you have an amendment.
Yes, I do.
And the label is A081108. Is that?
I think that's correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Would you like to go ahead and explain the...
Yes, I will move that. This is concerning this whole bill. It's about the absentee requirements. Members, all of these bills, you've heard of these concepts before. You know, last year we spent a lot of time getting up to speed. This year we can move quicker. What this would do is actually take the requirements that we had last year, that most of them aren't going to be effective until 2009. It actually moves up their implementation quicker. So, Mr. Chair, that's what that amendment does.
Okay. Okay. President Slawick offers the author's amendment to House File 2637, labeled A081108. Does everyone have the amendment? Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative, please present your bill.
Okay. Well, the next thing we're going to do is move House File 2689.
Okay.
Which I also have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair.
President Slawick moves that File 2689 be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Bill. Okay. And you have an amendment for this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill concerns child care assistance basic sliding fee waiting list reduction funding. As we know, members, one of the best ways we can help our families is with that basic sliding fee waiting list to get that reduced. It's the 826-89A2 amendment. And really, members, what this does is it temporarily changes the waiting list priority order in order to ensure the families who are not currently receiving assistance are served by new funds by moving, which is a little bit complicated, it moves the transition year families lower on the waiting list in priority order. Families finishing the transition year aren't in danger of losing their child care assistance, as there is already funding for these families. Temporarily changing the priority order for the new basic sliding fee allocation will ensure that the new funding translates into more families being served. So it's a way of changing the priority of who serves on the basic sliding fee list, and really it will help make sure more families are served.
Okay, and you move that, right?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Slawick moves the amendment labeled H2689A2. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment? Okay, and any questions? All right. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. And the amendment is approved and adopted. Okay.
What's we have next? One more, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right.
HS 2555.
Yes, House File 2555. Okay, Representative Slawick moves that House File 2555 be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Early Childhood and Learning Finance Bill. And you have an amendment for this bill?
No, there is
okay.
No amendment. And, Mr. Chair, this is the 1% rate increase. You know, members, some of what we do is we're going along the path of doing an omnibus bill, and so some of this language potentially could be included, and some of the financing could too if there's money. But we know with the economic forecast, this one will be a little bit less likely, but it continues with the idea of as costs increase out there, that we also, the legislature, increase the rate reimbursement.
Okay. Now, President Slawick moves the House File. There's so many of them. Okay, so House File 255 be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Bill. Okay, so do you want to proceed with the... Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Spawick, do you know the proposal here? Would this be, would TANF funds be eligible to be used for this purpose, or is that not a... I'm just trying to think of a way to help pay for this, and I know that there's, I think there's about 90-something million. Isn't that right?
Representative Spawick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there is money in the TANF fund, and it has to be used for... and I'm going to ask staff this for sure, but they have to be eligible, right? Is it for just, is it the MFIP portion, or can they be on the transition year or the waiting list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Braslow, I believe, I know that typically TANF funds are very easily used for MFIP healthcare because there are a number of fair maintenance of effort requirements that must be satisfied. So I believe, I mean, there are a number of things that can be used for TANF, and so I suspect that a lot of this could be funded through TANF dollars.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative
Mr. Chairman and Representative Flawick, the fiscal notes in a little different format. These aren't in thousands, are they? These are actually the real numbers. Is that right?
Flawick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I'm not sure exactly what you were looking at.
The fiscal notes that we have here it's not in a Department of Revenue format, and so I'm just looking here. I don't see anything that says it's in thousands. I can't imagine we.
That could be the right figure, right?
I can. Yes, Mr.
Adrian.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Mr. Chair, and Representative Graswell. Yes, this is not a typical fiscal note. You're right. We, instead of having a fiscal note, since the bill it says that it shall be increased by a blank percentage. The department was kind enough to run a whole schedule of a range from 1% to 6%, so we could see what the different costs would be accordingly. And they are the straight numbers; these are not in thousands.
Thank you, Ms. Adrian. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, Representative Swalwick. It's puzzled me a little bit. I know we put a lot of money into child care last year. I understood this to be an early childhood learning committee. And it seems to me, as a member of both of the Health and Human Services committees here in the House, that this is the sort of thing we ought to be dealing with under Health and Human Services. It's really that kind of a need we're meeting. I think, you know, I don't tend to agree completely that it's the state's responsibility to spend the kinds of money we're talking about on child care. There are lots of things you said about supporting families and helping families that I think are good. But I wonder if you have any response to that. Why are we doing this here in early childhood learning when, in fact, this is really a Health and Human Services issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, you know, there's kind of a long history of this committee, which I'll tell you a little bit about because it does relate to that, is way back when I first came to the legislature, it was the Children's Family and Learning Department where education and child care were combined at that point. And I know there's some people that have been on the staff nodding their heads a lot longer than I've been around that would know this history better. So it was pulled together. The idea is that for child care and young kids to look at the spectrum of what's happening with them. So having them in one area allowed that to happen, whether it was ECFE, Head Start, child care. Actually, that worked with some consolidation of costs for staff having to go to conferences and things like that. So then Palenti came in, well, Ventura was in there, and then Palenti, but it was pulled apart, and Department of Ed and Department of Human Services, it was separated back out. This committee was here when I first started with Representative Sikora, and then it went over to the Senate. Remember, Hottinger had it over there. We didn't have it over here, and now we have brought it back. We recall what happened to this bill last year is it goes up through Mary Murphy's committee, and then it actually does, in the Finance Committee, it splits. And so the child care portion actually goes on the Health and Human Services bill. The Head Start and ECFE goes on to Representative Freiling's bill. So eventually it does split off into those areas. But when the speaker became the speaker and the speakers get to designate what committees they want, and I had come to Niori and asked for this, she thought it would be a good idea to have an early childhood Learning Finance Committee, if you only take one half of the other, we're really not getting the picture of what happens with little kids in the state. So the only way to do this and to have this committee work effectively is to put the two together. Is it messy? Well, that's why we have Representative Peterson's bill. It's really messy because you try to get things like QRS, the common quality standards, and it's hard to translate from preschool to child care to what's going to work for both. But so eventually the answer, that's kind of the long answer, the short answer is it does split back out into the Health and Human Services bill. And the TANF monies and so forth, I guess Representative Garofalo's gone, is that we do wind up getting a TANF target through that child care portion. So we actually get a spending target through that.
Yep, Representative Garofalo. Or Gottwald, I'm sorry.
All good genius, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Flawick, how are we going to pay for this?
Well,
Representative Flawick.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, right now we're keeping it on the table to keep it in front of you. The reality is we will probably pick up, you know, I can just tell you this of an omnibus, so we'll probably pick up some of the language, the absent day language maybe, and because that speeds it up. And hopefully maybe some of the basic fighting fee language, that amendment, those two amendments, hopefully will be picked up. When we see the governor's budget next week, I think we're going to have a much better picture of what we're all going to be doing. And having lived through cuts once, I think we probably aren't going to have to worry about how to pay for anything. We're going to have to worry about cutting. So I think right now we wanted to hear about these ideas, but know that the financial reality is most of our bills in this legislature will not be about spending anything, but cutting. So for right now, it's just talking about keeping the ideas in front of you. Because if we wait until 2009, you probably know it's $2 billion next year is the expected deficit, so it even gets worse. So that why we're patching them together is more about keeping the ideas. And also, we have these specifiers here today that are going to talk about the need out there. And that's the hard part here at the legislature is, you know, we can have budget deficits, but the needs don't go away. I mean, you know that from human services. And not only do they not go away, we had, I guess I better not diatribe here too long, but we had met with a forecasting folks, and, you know, people can't get work, and so they're not using child care as much. The MFIP account is down because people can't find jobs. And so there's a really sort of a intuitively counterintuitive feeling there of you would think people would need more child care and they need less because they can't find anywhere to work and use that. So that's the answer. Right now we're just going to hear more about the needs and actually be able to fund them.
Okay. Any other questions? Should we go ahead with the testifiers then?
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say we have the room till 6:30, so hopefully we have four testifiers, maybe 5 to 10 minutes apiece would be great.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Ann McCulley, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you again. I'm wearing two hats today. I am representing the Board of Child Care Works, which is a statewide coalition of advocates and individuals working to develop public policy initiatives that increase the affordability, accessibility, and quality of child care. My other hat is the Executive Director of the Child Care Resource and Referral Network. And if you remember, we are an organization that helps support a system of 18 agencies around the state. Those agencies help parents find child care, support child care providers with grants, training, and other professional development, and work in partnership with many organizations on early childhood issues. My task today is to give that quick but broad overview of child care and child care assistance and the barriers for families and children we hope we can reduce by addressing these bills. Let me start by saying that, as you heard from Dr. Rolnick, the research is exceedingly clear on the architecture of young children's brains. We know children are learning all the time, whatever setting they're in, and we know that for at-risk children, these settings are critical, particularly in their early years. In Minnesota, most of our young children are in child care settings. Whether it's a child care center, a licensed family child care home, or with a family, friend, or neighbor, about 3/4 of Minnesota families with children under 13 regularly use some type of child care arrangement, and over 360,000 children spend some portion of their day in a licensed child care setting. Over a third of Minnesota's workers have children under the age of 18, and as you know, Minnesota boasts the highest work participation of women in the nation, with 75% of mothers with young children in the workforce. In a hearing the other day, Representative Wardlow, I believe you asked about the impact on workers and child care, and I was able to bring some statistics. In 2004, Wilder Research conducted a child care use study in Minnesota, asking some questions about the impact of child care and their work. 20% of parents said that child care problems had interfered with their getting or keeping a job in the past year. Child care problems that interfere with employment more commonly affected parents of color, parents who have a child with a special need, parents with low incomes, and parents who have child care subsidies than other parents by about 2 to 1. 37% of households said that they or their spouse or partner had lost time or income in the last 6 months due to a child care problem other than a sick child. And the number of parents who reported they had to take whatever care they could get increased from 8% in 2001, the last time the study was done, to 29% in 2004. So we still have a large problem with access to child care. We are very concerned that the impact of over $213 million in cuts to child care assistance since 2003 has continued to erode the stability of the whole child care sector. As of this past December, we had 11,800 family child care providers and 2,000 center-based programs in the state. Unfortunately, as Representative Slawick said, we've seen a net loss of nearly 1,500 licensed child care programs between July of 2003 and December of 2007, and I should clarify that that's the net loss, meaning some have closed and some have opened. We've actually seen over 8,000 programs close over that 4.5 years. Every closing has multiple impacts. It means the loss of a business, the loss of the training and experience of that provider, and on average we see providers in the business between 10 and 15 years. It means loss of stability for the family that rely on that provider, and perhaps the most important measure, the severing of the close relationships that have been built between the provider and those children. It's in all of our best interest to help good providers stay in business. Another large barrier to access is the cost of care, which is what we'll be talking about most today. Most families who use child care have out-of-pocket expenses. Minnesota parents spend $1.2 billion annually on child care. By contrast, the state spends less than 1% of the annual budget on child care. Households with low incomes shoulder the biggest cost burden relative to their incomes. For upper-income families, child care will usually take about 7% of their income, while for low-income families, child care can run as high as 30% of their gross income. At the same time, families with young children are usually at a low point of income earnings, given that they're likely in the early stages of their career. Expenses can range widely, and as Representative Slawick pointed out, it can be $30,000 across the course of a child care lifetime, if you will. Another scenario I can tell you is that for a family with a preschool-age child and an infant in full-time care, the average can run between $15,000 and $24,000 per year in the metro area and $12,000 to $16,000 in greater Minnesota, depending on what type of setting they're in. It's hard not to see that the cost of care is a large concern for parents of all income levels, but of course particularly for low-income families. Now, while the legislature did take action last year to cap what those on child care assistance can pay as co-payment at 14% of their income, low-income families currently on the waiting list have no way to afford care. And although eligibility is not the focus of these bills, I would add that right now the ceiling that we set for basic sliding fee is just above $30,000 for a family of three and just under $43,000 for a family of four. So someone making over $30,000 for a family of three is not eligible for assistance. And given the cost I just stated to you, I think you can see the dilemma. Now, the answer is not for child care programs simply to lower their rates, as sometimes people suggest. Child care programs already operate on the thinnest of margins and in some areas operate at a loss. It's an extremely labor-intensive business. Between July 2003 and today, while child care's market rates have increased because facilities, rents, utilities, and other business costs, of course, have gone up, the reimbursement rates the state pays have remained virtually flat. The 2003 freeze, which we've talked about, was actually based on market rates from 2001. And despite a small increase in 2006, we're not even close to covering the actual market rate, and many providers are still struggling. Based on last year's figures, we would have needed a rate increase of at least 14% in order to reach the market rate. Now, while some programs you've heard about, such as the School Readiness Connections Program and the fact that the accreditation differential was reinstated, has helped some providers close that gap, the overall access numbers aren't changing, and in fact, they're getting worse. We built our child care assistance system based on offering child care choices for parents. In fact, the federal government requires that we give families equal access to different types of care. In 2005, we were at the 55th percentile for access to centers, and we were sent a warning letter from the federal government that said we should get back to market rates. We were not providing equal access. The most current data that the department showed you just the other day shows that only 40% of centers and 55% of family child care providers are technically within reach to child care assistance families, unless they or the program or a third party can pay that difference. In 2001, by comparison, more than 80% of all providers felt within reach. So there's a huge gap in terms of access. I just want to make a couple of additional points, and Representative Flawick touched on these. Prior to 2003, we were ranked fifth in the nation in terms of eligibility. We are now 42nd out of 50 states. We are one of only 17 states that either doesn't budget enough for child care or doesn't forecast for it. And a monthly average of 16,000 families and 29,000 children were served with both MFIP and basic sliding fee programs in 2007, about 8,000 families each. But, as you heard, 4,000 families are currently on the waiting list, so half again as many families as are being served are on the waiting list. Although child care assistance reflects only a portion of the overall market, it has a huge effect on the entire market. When a center or family child care program has to scrimp on quality, all of the children are affected. If a program closes, all the children and families are out of luck. And if we reduce access to care for child care assistance families, particularly to quality care programs, we do not see the long-term savings to society that you heard cited by Dr. Rolnick earlier. And to your point earlier, Representative Scott Walt, we sometimes struggle to make this connection, make it clear that in our mind, child care is early education, and that whether a child is in a preschool room of a child care center or in a standalone four-year-old program, in a standalone preschool or a Head Start program, those are all early learning settings if it's a quality program, and that they all need to be looked at in terms of investment, and early learning can and does happen. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative
Wallach. Well, our next, I always like the parents to go earlier in the agenda, and somehow they wind up at the end of the agenda, so I would like Wendy Weber to go next, who's a Maplewood parent, and then we'll have, and if she comes here, you want to come sit up here? You sure? Star for a day? Your mom's a star, huh? We appreciate you being here. And
welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Wendy Weber. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It is a pleasure to be before this committee. My name is Wendy Weber, and I am from the city of Maplewood. My son Troy Weber was born on March 27, 2006. Shortly after his birth, around April 2006, I contacted Ramsey County to seek child care assistance for him. I was told that there was currently no funds available and in the program and was put on a waiting list. Since that day, I contacted Ramsey County to check on my status several times. The last time I checked a few months ago, I was told that I was a 74th on the list and there are no funds right now available. My husband is self-employed. He has his own house gutter business. As you probably know, the economy is not strong, and winter is a slow period for the business. I've been employed at Health East as a pharmacy tech and now as a registration rep for 10 years. I'm currently a part-time worker due to health issues. My employment is the only way we can afford health care and dental benefits for my family. Our combined income is approximately $17,000 per year. Our child care expense is $125 per week at an in-home child care professional. Although Troy is loved and is well taken care of, he is not receiving a lot of learning opportunities that I see other children his age receiving. This is more than we can really afford, but is at least expensive option we have at this time. With all of our expenses and stagnant economy, we are struggling to be self-sufficient. If we could get child care assistance, it would help us tremendously in our financial situation. I would even be able to send Troy to a child care center that would offer him a more stimulating educational environment so he could begin to get ready for school. Thank you for listening to me, and I am willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Good job. Are there any questions from members? Okay. You want to... Oh, sorry. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to thank the testifier, because I want to say that we appreciate having you here, and I have received at least 3 different calls from people who are women. These are all women, either supporting a loan, in one instance supporting a loan 2 children, one with a husband who had lost a job, and one where the income together wasn't enough, and all of them wondering where they could get help with paying for child care, because it is such a big expense, and the funds just don't stretch far enough to pay for the rent and for the food and the other things. And I'm heartbroken, because they're, you know, even looking and having research looking, we're having trouble finding the places where we can find those resources. So just wanted to know that it's good to have you come and testify so everybody hears your story. Thank you.
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your salary, $17K for the family, and your weekly child expenses are $125 a week. Is that, do I hear correctly?
$17,000
a year, yeah. Yeah, so I said, yeah. Well, so your child care is 38% of your family income. I did a little bit of arithmetic here.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you eat?
Well, just the last couple of years we've had to borrow money from my husband's parents. That's how we're getting through the winter.
Okay.
Just the winter months are hard right now. But we're cutting it pretty tough right now.
Yeah. Thank you. I just wanted to point out that percentage.
Yeah, it was kind of, it's not good last year.
Thank you, Representative Wardlaw. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flowers.
How old is your son now?
He's 8, and Troy's 2.
Oh, he's 2. Okay. Well, I just want to say, along with the committee, we appreciate you coming today. We sometimes there's a legislature, we talk to each other more than we talk to real people, and so it's really important having you here, so we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bobick, do you have another testifier?
Good morning. Chad Dunkley, who's from New Horizons, and then we have a family child care provider, Mr. Chair, after that.
All right.
And then we will be...
Okay, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Chad Dunkley, president of the Minnesota Child Care Association. I know you've seen my face a lot. There are 15 to 20 people from the Minnesota Child Care Association here. If you'd wave your hand so you can see there's more faces, some here, some there. They just happen to always tell me to be the one to talk to you for some reason, but they do agree with what I'm going to tell you, I can say that. It's hard to go after a parent like Wendy, because the providers in this room see families like that every day. And they're not only sacrificing things like food, but it's health care and appropriate health care, dental care. I mean, there's tons and tons of families who are very challenged with the child care crisis that we're in. But I, again, I'm coming to this committee to talk to you about some of the challenges facing low-income families and the access issues for child care that exist. Some things were mentioned. Representative Slav did a great job, as did Ann McCauley, talking about the statistics that came out again this year from the National Women's Law Center about our rankings in a number of areas, including we're now 42nd on income eligibility, one of 17 states that put you on waiting lists. But and I think that's a double whammy, by the way. We don't let a lot of families get help for child care, but even the ones that do qualify, we say, sorry, you qualify, but we ran out of money, and we put them on waiting lists. And 17, again, only 17 states do that. And that waiting list, by the way, has grown by 48% from the statistics you were given last week here, from the numbers you were given from the 2006 numbers. So a waiting list is a big problem. But mostly I'm here to talk about the reimbursement rate issue. I think there's some misconceptions about that, but there's also some information, and I passed out two copies of two things. One is what Sheree Kapelnik, who's here, passed out last week because it has some good information on it. And then the second is the letter that we were given from the federal government that Ann McCauley mentioned last week about our warning from the federal government about not meeting the criteria. But one of the things that I think is interesting, in Minnesota for some reason we've forgotten the purpose originally of child care assistance. And I think that there's so much more to it now. We have even more studies, and for some reason we're making no progress. When child care was invented, was started, it was done when we wanted to transform this country, and the concept of welfare to work came through the federal government. And this was in the 90s, and really Democrats and Republicans discussed, if we're going to do this, how do we do it successfully? Will we do it successfully by making sure that we provide work support for low-income families? You can't go to work if you're missing some crucial pieces. And if you have young children, a crucial piece to being successful at work is child care. And we've seen millions of people move off the welfare system because of child care. We've got a lot of success stories, and I know we get to tell you about what's wrong with Minnesota, but we have a state right next door that's the most successful state, Wisconsin, at transferring families off of welfare. One of the reasons they're so successful, they forecast for child care up to 200% of federal poverty level. They have no waiting list, and they pay reimbursement rates at the recommended federal level. One of the challenges of Minnesota being successful and really helping a lot of these families is we don't do that. We actually have a child care system that's an impediment to a successful workforce. And I understand you have a $1 billion problem coming ahead, but it's these times that we look at things that help our future economy. It's these times that you do the right things. Families, Art Rolnick and I had this conversation before. He said people need child care more when the economy's bad than when it's good. I know that there's some cases here of families not finding jobs. For any family that does find a job, we need to keep them in that job. Mm-hmm. And we're not able to do that when child care is not supported. And so, you know, unfortunately, our neighbors are doing a far better job at this than we are, and they have a lot less challenges when it comes to this system. But I do want to touch on as well, you have this letter from the federal government, and we should respect them because they supply about half the child care assistance dollars that we spend in Minnesota, and they have rules for keeping those dollars, and one of the rules is you need to give families equal access to the same types of providers that families in the private marketplace have. They suggest that you reimburse at the 75th percentile of market rate to do that. Well, they found that Minnesota wasn't doing that when we set in our state plan in 2005, which will be, or 2006 for 2005, we'll be doing that again this summer, and they said to us, you're not meeting the federal requirements. You need to pick it up. You need to get back to market rates. We've gone now from the 52nd percentile of center rates, I think Ann McCauley mentioned, to the 40th. It's pretty clear the federal government's going to say you continue to violate the requirements of the Equal Access Clause, and you need to do something about it, and Minnesota's not following the guidelines. And it's pretty embarrassing. I know Representative Falk has a bill here, and I know it's somewhat hard to pay for. And I totally agree that you have a budget problem. But the reality is, our estimates show that about 3-4% rate increase this year would at least keep families from losing ground. And in a biennium, that's $17 million. In the next biennium, it's only $6 because we're a year late, $6 million. I agree, that's maybe hard to find, but you have a lot bigger budget than this mother that just talked to you earlier who's spending 38% of her income on child care. And I think $17 million is a little easier to find. I know it's a big budget, and we just need some champions that decide that they're going to do the right thing and not let us go further behind. But we also have a good reason. The federal government's not going to let us keep doing this year after year after year, saying we're going to kind of fix this. The last time we told them about this, we had rate changes the next year, and they laid off. We didn't see another letter. Well, we didn't do anything last year, and I know child care was supposed to get some funding. The House and Senate passed a 2% rate increase last year. And it didn't make it in the final numbers. There was no increase. And as a provider, my costs have definitely increased. And unfortunately, the difference for families has grown. And I think that's also a misconception. We keep talking about providers suffer when they serve just low-income families when it comes to reimbursement rates. But the federal government didn't say we need a market rate system because of providers. They said it for families. It's about family access. When a provider has a rate and the state doesn't keep up with it, that parent, the difference between the provider rate and the state rate is charged to the family. The family already has a significant copay that can be 14% of their income, and eventually that difference and that copay make the family budget crash, even if you get into the system. And What we're finding in the system is families are losing access and having to leave programs that get children ready for school. When we did this welfare at work thing, we knew we were helping people successfully get into the workforce now. What we didn't know is what Art was saying about a 17% fixed return, all those things, which has nothing to do with the parents. It has to do with the kids. So child care now isn't about just supporting the current economy, it's about supporting the future economy in this state. So I understand you have a $1 billion budget problem, and I understand this year there's going to be a good reason why we're not going to fix child care. But when we had a $1 billion surplus last year, we didn't fix it either. And it won't be fixed until we have true legislative champions who are determined that they're not going to take no for an answer on this issue. So we hope this committee can do that, and we hope that you can do that, because this problem is growing every year, and every year it's going to be a bigger problem to fix, and we have budget problems from here to eternity. So please take this year and do something for child care for families like the one you heard behind us, because their budgets are a lot tougher than the one you have to figure out. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the testifier? Seeing none, do you have another testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank Mr. Dunkley. He's been worked very tirelessly on behalf of child care and for getting folks here and for talking about what is a difficult issue and for being a champion. And we hope to, you know, they say if you don't have the vision, you'll never get there. So we've got to continue to have the vision and continue to have the hope and know that this will turn around eventually, and we've got to keep that in sight. So thank you. Mr. Chair, I have one more testifier coming up.
Okay.
Who is a family child care provider. And I just, for all of you that the committee's getting low here because we usually are done by this time, as everybody knows, this session went late. But just to say, as a parent of children, one of the toughest work environments happens to be right here. You know, we had a session at 9:30 last night. And, you know, I'm a single parent, and the choice was what? Leave my kids alone. Not vote, which we don't want anyone to hear that, or what are you supposed to do? You know, these really present tough challenges. And same thing, here we are at 6 o'clock at night and we're working, you know, with this very irregular schedule. I did get it handled and traded for the hockey game and, you know, et cetera. So I'm on duty tonight and he took them last night. But it's just that kids, when people are forced into choices, and when you see people, and we can make it and pay for it, but it would be finding it at that hour. But a lot of parents, even paying for it and finding good child care is such a challenge. So for all of you that are out there providing it, thank you. It is something I think a lot of families are leaving kids home alone because they just don't know what else to do. And so I think we have all the provider issues, and then we have all the family issues that I'll play into this. So, and Lisa and I visited this afternoon, and I think you'll learn something from her testimony. So appreciate you being here today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Slavik. Would you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Thompson, and I am a family child care provider. For the past 15 years, I've had a child care business in my home. I am also serving as president of a union for family child care providers, called CCPP in Ramsey County. I serve as a district coordinator for Child Care Works, and before that, I worked in child care centers as well, and my background is in elementary education. Just so people understand what family child care is, we transform our homes to provide a stimulating and loving, safe environment for a small group of mixed age group of children. We operate a licensed and regulated facility regulated by the county in accordance with state law. It's up to 2 adults, depending on the license, and up to 14 children. In any given day, we are a caregiver, of course, but many people don't see that we're also educators. We're accountants and bookkeepers, nurses, cooks, custodians, family social workers, children's advocates, peace negotiators, and of course, we're entertainers. This is all in the course of one day. It's a very multi-tasked role that we play. Many families choose family child care for their families, and there's a variety of reasons. I'm just going to give you a few of them here. Some of the main reasons people choose family child care is that it's a small personal group setting
And it allows for securely bonded relationships. And people from that are preaching about the importance of children being ready for kindergarten. That's one of the most important skills that children need in being successful in school, is having the social skills and the bonding in the early years to do well in school. Family child care allows for the flexibility of schedule, exactly what Representative Slowick just spoke on. Family child care also allows for the mixed ages to stay together. It means younger children are able to learn from the older children. Siblings stay together. And also, older children have the opportunity of experiencing what many smaller families don't have anymore, and that's a large family, and it's an extended family, and how important that is, especially in the day that families are so disconnected across many miles. We offer convenience that many other learning situations can't provide, because we're right in the community. We're right next door to families. We look like the community because we are the community. Family child care also provides for consistent and stable caregiving, because we are one person providing the care. Our family child care provider that I spoke to described the state of family child care similar to the plight that family farms may have experienced, and in that we're being put out of the mix in early learning by the corporate farms. And early learning and care have been happening in family child care and in homes for as long as women have worked, which is pretty much forever. The nature of early learning and care are inseparable. So when you say that, when people talk about child care maybe not being the state's responsibility, I believe that educating our children is the state's responsibility, because they are the infrastructure that our society is based on. And it is our responsibility to make sure that they're being educated. And since children are in child care, we need to make sure that their experience is a stimulating and productive learning environment. So they go hand in hand, and they believe that they're inseparable. It's very important to family child care providers that we receive the support in obtaining the education that we need to provide those kind of education experiences, as well as removing the barriers that keep us from continuing in our education and obtaining the kind of education that we need to do our jobs well, and also to be included in the programs that are developed in offering parents quality care and how to evaluate what quality care is. Family child care is all over the state, and early learning experiences are happening in those homes. And we need to make sure that they continue to be good experiences. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the members? Comments? No? Seeing none, Representative Slavik, would you like to make a final comment about your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chen. I want to thank Lisa for coming. She's also working with us on, she just sat in Mary Murphy's committee last week on a number of issues that there are between the state and family child care providers, and we appreciate you coming forward and working through those with us. I said, you know, it takes 2, 3, 4, 5 years for some of these things to happen. But if people don't talk to us about if the state's over-regulating or has things that just don't work, we don't always know that. So we appreciate you coming forward on that, and we'll continue to work with you. Mr. Chair, just to say again, thank you to those folks that came. I think that we need to continue, members, to remember what this is about, and it's about the care of our young children and the state's role in that, and that the state does have a big role, and we need to continue for what's going to be a rough couple of weeks here to keep in mind what we've heard here today, and that we make sure we don't go backwards, that we continue moving forward, and we're doing the right thing for the future of our state. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Gottwald, you did have a question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. And I think it's important that we have these philosophical discussions around these things, too. Representative Slawick and I have had many conversations along these lines. I've mentioned these things in committee before. I'm not ignorant of the need for child care in Minnesota, and I appreciate what all of you here do, the services that you provide. My frustration comes from the philosophy that suggests that it is now the responsibility of the state and child care providers who are struggling to do for children what parents are supposed to do for children. And that is also not ignorant of the fact that people have to work, and so they find daycare for their kids. But when we have our children, the first educators, the first caregivers, and what studies show, and we haven't heard a lot of that here in this committee, what studies show is the best place for our children to learn and be cared for is with their family, with their parents. Now, I know that there are situations, and our earlier testifier is an example of where that's simply not possible. But we are moving as a society towards one that births our children and gives them to the state or to daycare providers or school districts to raise. And that's a disturbing trend. Because I care so much about the quality of education for our young people, I have kids all the way from 3.5 up to 19 right now, 5 kids. I've stood in an unemployment line. I started with a job of $10,000 a year. But my wife and I have made a strong commitment that we will always, first and foremost, be the educators, the ones responsible for conveying values and character and preparing our kids for school so that they're ready to learn. And my concern philosophically is that the more we do what we're doing here, the more we give parents permission to not be parents. And that is a deep concern. And I know it's frustrating for some people to hear that, but we need to think about that. These philosophical underpinnings, the foundation of society, as you mentioned, is at stake here. And we have to think overall, what is good for our society? What can make Minnesota great? So I respect what you all represent. I respect the need for child care in Minnesota, but I also have concerns for what this means for the family and for the true well-being of our young people going forward.
Would you like to comment?
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, I appreciate you sharing that. I actually think we're not that far apart on the philosophy of parents being first teachers, and I think probably most of us agree with that. And, you know, I think that in whatever... You know, if I think I have it rough, I think of someone else who has it a lot rougher. And if you think of, you know, people, the whole pull yourself up by the bootstraps sort of philosophy works for a lot of people, but it doesn't work for everyone. Not everyone has the same abilities or the same opportunities. But I that being said, yes, I mean, when we have an early childhood committee here at the legislature, it is about parents, of course, being the first teachers of their families, and then figuring out what the role of the state is. And I've always said that. I mean, when you see these bills on four-year-olds coming out, it isn't about going through the school system, creating a public system. It's about keeping a private system also, and so that people have those choices out there about what they do with their kids. But I think that it takes a village, and I think that I know my child care provider has been very important in my life. I had my oldest, who is a junior in high school now, so that tells you probably could stay alone at 9:30 at night. But it's kicked out of preschool at, you know, age 3 because they saw some things with him, and I was asked if I, you know, contacted my public school system, which I did, and he was placed in special ed. But it was child care providers that said, you know, I think something's going on here, you know, especially with people with their oldest kids. As you said, you wear those many hats. It's not just caring for someone's child, but you're just with that child, you know, quite a bit during the day and kind of seeing that. I've always been lucky to work part-time, so I've never had to work full-time since my kids were born. But so goes debate, and we see it, you know, we sit on a lot of the same, you're on E-12 policy, where we had some of this going on this morning. We had, and then we had, we're both on Health and Human Services. And it is the great thing about the legislature is it's our place to bring these concerns. And nobody's necessarily right, but it's in the struggle we find the good. So with that, I'm sure out of this, hopefully the good will be found and the best thing for families.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Representative Blair. And to Mr. Gottwald's point, I have to weigh in on this because I did welfare advocacy many years ago and worked with the families in Rice County. And I look at this, this is a tool for parents. We need tools. These are parents that I worked with were housekeepers, nursing assistants, laundry workers, in our nursing homes, hospitals, state institutions for the blind and the deaf, and other areas where women work at low wages and hard, back-breaking work. And the need is there for them to work. But first and foremost, they're parents. And they're nurturing, loving parents who feel secure when they know their children are in a safe environment. And on top of that, when they do receive the tools to learn to read, to learn to color, to learn to cooperate, to learn to get along, those are wonderful tools. And I come from a long line of folks like my folks who we didn't have child care. We raised ourselves, basically. And we didn't know about, we didn't have these things back in 1952. So I'm very grateful. And I also am concerned. We do need to watch. I don't want this to become a state institution of our children. And I don't think any of the providers do either. And the parents need to weigh in. And it's a great tool for parents. And we need to continue to fund this. I look at this, you're as poorly funded as nursing homes. It's always the most vulnerable, our children and our elderly in this country. And we need to really take a closer look and a brave step forward and do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're nearing our end of time here, is that correct? And so we probably need to close up our debate. So Representative Slavik renews her motion for the... which one am I on here now? The House 2555 bill. To be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Bill. So, should you want to assume the chair again, or should I adjourn from here? Okay. With that, we'll adjourn the meeting.
Thank you.